You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Director of the John Cage Trust, and this week's program is our third to focus on the endeavors of Robert Warby, a composer, sound artist, and broadcaster based in London. The first, on April 2nd, centered on his work with Laurie Lixenberg and Gregory Rose that resulted in the 2012 CD titled John Cage Songbooks. And the second, on April 9th, centered on his work with the performing ensemble Langham Research Center that resulted in the 2014 CD titled John Cage Early Electronic and Tape Music, both released on the Sub Rosa label. To recap something of particular relevance to tonight's program from previous introductions, Warby began broadcasting on BBC Radio 3 in the mid-1990s, presenting a five-part series entitled Cacophony Now that explored how dissonance and noise interface with contemporary music. Since that time, he has become a regular presenter of Here and Now, the BBC's main contemporary music program, and has made several features on subjects including the work of Daphne Oram, the founder of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, the music of the notorious futurist composer and painter Luigi Russolo, and most recently, Karlheinz Stockhausen, with a documentary program entitled Then There Was Light, that focuses on Stockhausen's vast opera cycle, Licht, composed between 1977 and 2004. Among other of Warby's recent endeavors for BBC Radio 3 is tonight's program, Silent Witness, John Cage, Zen, and Japan, a BBC Radio Cumbria production that first aired in 2020, produced by Andrew Carter. As introduced by Warby at its initial airing, John Cage is arguably the most important composer of the 20th century, even though he's perhaps famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, for writing a piece of music that is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Famous because it made his reputation. After all, composers write music, not silence. And infamous because, not unsurprisingly, it's outraged, perplexed, and fascinated audiences since its premiere in 1952. Cage, though, was deadly serious about his silent piece, and Warby goes on an odyssey to find out what Cage thought silence was and why silence was central to his life and work. He goes to the quietest place in the UK, so quiet you can't hear a pin drop, to experience what Cage did when he entered an anechoic chamber in the 50s in search of silence. But it's not as straightforward as you might think. As Warby discovers, Cage didn't find the silence he was seeking, and instead found something even more surprising. The key to understanding 433 and Cage's fascination with silence is his interest in the discipline of Zen Buddhism, which unlocked a whole new world of hearing sound that he charted through chance operations. It led to a meeting of like minds when Cage met Yoko Ono in New York, who instantly saw the Zen influence on his work. In 1962, Ono and her husband, Toshi Ishianagi, invited Cage to visit Japan, his Zen spiritual homeland. This was a turning point in Cage's career, where his groundbreaking performances sealed his reputation as the most controversial and experimental composer in the world. The program features two UK premieres on BBC Radio 3, an interview Warby recorded with Cage when he met the composer in his Manhattan loft in the 1980s after finding his number in the phone book, and Cage reading his Lecture on Nothing, his enigmatic musing on silence. Now, on to Silent Witness, John Cage, Zen, and Japan.
I have nothing to say, and I am saying it. And that is poetry, as I need it.
Here, for the first time on the BBC, is the composer John Cage, in a very rare recording, reading lecture on nothing from his seminal book, Silence.
We need not fear these silences. We may love them.
It's really moving listening to this. And when or where this was recorded is a mystery. But one thing I'm sure about, John Cage was a remarkably inventive composer, a one-off who demonstrated an important principle, that all sounds, even silence, can be music. Cage is the high priest of silence. His silent piece, 4 minutes 33 seconds, made him famous.
My freshmen in college come in, they don't come in knowing much, but they usually come in knowing about 4:33.
In less than 5 silent minutes, Cage sent shockwaves through music. Silence had found its voice.
What we require is silence. But what silence requires is that I go on talking.
What is little understood is that Cage's unique engagement with silence came about through the remarkable flowering of Japanese Zen Buddhism in America in the 1950s. Zen is a method of training the mind, seeing into your true nature and the true nature of reality, transforming the suffering of yourself and others. Cage studied Zen, and I want to show how Zen changed his life and music.
Silence is important for Cage because he wants to connect to something bigger than himself.
Cage put silence back in the center of Western art, and in the process, artists who saw him do that said, "Wow, when you are in this place of silence, look how much more you can see. Look how much more is possible. You don't have to worry about yourself anymore."
He wants to connect directly to the universe of sound. And if you're not quiet, you're just getting in the way.
This program is also about a remarkable friendship. In the 1950s, Cage met Yoko Ono in New York, long before she became an international celebrity. They studied Japanese Zen Buddhism together, and in 1962, she invited him to Japan, and this became an important turning point in his life. Kay Larson is a practicing Buddhist. She has fascinating things to say about Cage's engagement with Japanese culture, and she believes there's a Cage before Zen and a Cage after Zen, and they're markedly different people.
He sought silence for about 20 years in various ways. And when he finally found silence in the form of Zen Buddhism and his teacher D.T. Suzuki, then he saw a path to really make silence and to transform his own work in relation to the silence.
What interests me far more than anything that happens is the fact of how it would be if nothing were happening.
I've been absorbed with John Cage's music since I was a teenager, and in the late 80s, I was in New York on tour with a rock band. I was surprised to see that he was listed in the phone book, so I rang him up.
Tuesday the 26th of July at 2 o'clock, talking with John Cage in New York City.
You think it's working? On the phone, he said, "Come over now." I said, "Won't I be disturbing you?" He said, "I'm disturbed all the time. It won't make any difference." So I went right over. I couldn't believe it. There I was in his apartment, sitting with him at his table by the open window with my cassette recorder.
How do you feel about, well, young people like me come and
talk to you about pieces like 4 minutes 33 seconds, which I think is the most important piece of music written in the 20th century. Uh-huh. How do you feel about it? You're the person who wrote it.
I agree with that.
You do? Do you think it's the best piece you've ever written?
I don't use the word best. But I think it's basic to my work.
It's the starting point.
It still is.
You might think that a vast open desert or a solitary mountaintop would be a suitable location for the 20th century's silent witness. But John kept his window wide open. And as you can hear, our conversation was drowned out by the hubbub of the Big Apple.
I don't have the story here, but I'm sure that it talks about
making music on tape.
Pretend you're on a city sidewalk. Now, listen to the voice of the city's traffic.
Laura Kuhn, friend of the composer and director of the John Cage Trust.
His apartment, 18th Street and 6th Avenue, was one of the noisiest intersections in New York City. So I think he saw living in Manhattan and living in perhaps overpopulated space a way to change his mind, a way to change. You know, he used the world to grow, to become a different person.
Cage was raised in Los Angeles on the west coast of America, and he brought an early counterculture sensibility to mainstream America. He believed that silence could change minds and change the world, and 4 minutes 33 seconds would be a catalyst. Cage musicologist Kyle Gann.
In the case of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, Cage was responding to an Asian idea in terms of Zen, but he put it in kind of a European format by having this three-movement recital-like piece. And it was kind of a perfect fusion of these two different parts of the world meeting in America.
The music critic Paul Griffiths has written extensively about 20th century music, but for him, Cage's achievements put him in a class of his own.
He was the one who made a piece of music out of silence. 4 minutes 33 seconds is the white paper on which all his other works are written.
Let's scour the traffic. The session's about to start.
It was in the rural setting of Woodstock, 90 miles from New York, and not in downtown Manhattan, that 4 minutes 33 seconds was premiered in 1952. Imagine what it was like. After playing some dazzlingly difficult pieces, the pianist David Tudor came back onto the stage of the Maverick Concert Hall and gave a performance of a piece, the likes of which had never been seen or heard before.
He sits quietly and meditates as he performs 4:33. He's closing the piano lid so that he can't make music. And if he can't make music, then the rest of the world is making its own music, and that's what he's listening to.
Composer and David Tudor scholar Martin Idden.
You know that you are listening to a performer who means it and who can really play. And when you've heard that, that puts you in a particular frame of mind about that performer, about the sorts of things that he plays, that means that even when faced with a piece in which he's going to play nothing, that at least adds some sort of sense that he believes in it, and you ought to believe in him. So the audience at least has a chance that they might listen to this absence of music with musical ears.
David Tudor said that performing 4 minutes 33 seconds was the most intense listening experience you can have.
And it's so beautiful. And I've seen 4:33 so many times, and every single time it's exactly the same, and every single time it's totally different. And it's because there are no ideas, it's just pure experience. It's profound.
But in 1952, Middle America was on a different wavelength to John Cage.
The audience was largely New York Philharmonic members on vacation and just the worst possible people to accept something like this. And apparently at the end, someone yelled, "Good people of Woodstock, let's run these people out of town."
Cage feared that people would think he was mad writing 4 minutes 33 seconds. Composers write music, not silence. The composer Christian Wolff, who was then only 18 and a pupil of Cage, vividly remembers the furore surrounding the premiere.
I told my parents, hey, I'm going to get my music played on this concert. And by the way, there's this piece on the concert I should warn you about. It consists entirely of silence. And my mother, who incidentally is not particularly musical, but somehow she found it not a good idea. And so she wrote this letter to Cage and said, John, you know, nobody will ever take you seriously again if you do this.
Part 33 did not become notorious as fast as people assume it did. When Cage wrote Silence in 1961, the book made him famous. Then people started going back and looking at 433. And he only mentions 433 in there twice, and he doesn't even do it by name. He just calls it My Silent Piece. You know, Lamont Young swears to me, who's very, very influenced by Cage, swore to me that in the early 60s he hadn't yet heard of 433.
Its 33 seconds is not really silent. And this is one of the paradoxes at the heart of Cage's music and thinking. Cage music specialist James Pritchett.
And we've all had experiences, everybody has, of being out in the world, particularly, say, out in a beautiful natural spot, where just the ambient sound around you it's all part of this beautiful experience that can be very, very touching for us, right? We've all had those experiences. And that's what Cage is about. And he's bringing that into the concert hall.
But 4 minutes, 33 seconds can be experienced in a rainforest or an urban jungle. Here is the 4 minutes, 33 seconds that Cage would have experienced every day. The third movement, recorded by Gene Caprioleo, outside Cage's New York apartment on November the 6th at 3:39 p.m. in 2013. As Cage said, it's hard to believe that he composed 4 minutes 33 seconds silent bar by silent bar. The priceless original autograph manuscript is sadly now lost, but a score is published that gives clues to Cage's intentions.
You can see it in his score for 433, the Tacet score. And Tacet, as an instruction to an orchestral musician, which is where you see it, is always, the meaning is, you be quiet while other people are doing something, you know? And that's really important. It doesn't mean silence. It means you don't do anything.
The young Christian Wolff was unfazed by 4 minutes, 33 seconds, but he'd been taught at a Quaker school.
And as you know, Quaker meetings consist of silence, and if someone feels impelled to talk, they can, but many, many minutes go by with absolutely nothing happening. So the experience of sitting listening to 4 minutes 33 seconds was completely familiar to me because of this experience, this Quaker experience in school.
Silence seems to have been kind of a lifelong preoccupation for Cage. When he was in high school, he gave a lecture that won an award, and it was on stopping the great machinery of capitalism and just listening to what the rest of the world is saying. And it has this eloquent passage about letting all the machinery run down and finally just being quiet and so we can listen to other people.
Half intellectually and half sentimentally, when the war came along, I decided to use only quiet sounds. There seemed to me to be no truth, no good in anything big in society. But quiet sounds were like loneliness, or love, or friendship. Permanent, I thought, values, independent at least from life, time, and Coca-Cola.
Later in life, Cage remembered studying with Adolf Weiss in New York in 1934. His instinctive use of silence had irritated the older man, who was perplexed and returned Cage's scores marked up in red ink.
It no sooner began, I remember one of his remarks states, than it stops. And there's no reason to expect, he says, after that stop, that the piece of music is still living.
Yes.
Therefore, I should, if I was going to make music more traditionally, I should learn not to have those silences.
Christian Wolff had first-hand experience of Cage's finely tuned ear for silence.
We go to the new school where Henry Cowell is teaching. We're early and there's a rehearsal going on of one of the Bach Brandenburg concertos. And it's playing along and we're standing at the back and suddenly there's a pause in the music and Cage murmurs to me, says, "That's beautiful." The empty space.
You know, Cage announced in 1948 in a lecture at Vassar University that he wanted to write a silent piece and that it was going to be 4.5 minutes long and that he wanted to sell it to the Muzak Corporation. When 433 came on the Muzak, you'd have blessed silence for 4.5 minutes. He couldn't do it until he went through all of the Zen influenced and decided that there was a deeply spiritual reason to do it as well, made it more of a positive, life-affirming piece instead of a protest.
He became friends with the painter, Robert Rauschenberg. And Rauschenberg had made this painting, which consisted actually of four panels, all of them painted white. And I mean, white like the wall. And there was no texture, nothing, just pure white. So the nearest visual thing you might say to silence. And when Cage saw that, he got up the nerve to make his own version.
Cage might be thought of as an archetypal American pioneer. Perhaps his silence was the silence of the great empty frontier. But what made him so radical was his hearing silence as music. A thought echoed by Gavin Bryars, who was one of a group of English composers who saw Cage for the revolutionary that he was.
I think silence is central to all music. It's the one thing, you know, the one thing that we do with music, we bring something into being out of silence. When you start a piece in a classical work or any other work in an auditorium, you start when the room has gone silent, when there's an absence of intended sound, when you maybe only have a bit of shuffling. In fact, the conductor will often wait until the last cough has stopped before starting. So music needs to start from silence. And what Cage relished was the fact he enjoyed that silence. He enjoyed that moment before the music begins and prolonged it immensely.
But it was a personal crisis in Cage's life that really focused his mind on silence, put him on the path to 4 minutes 33 seconds and the discovery of Zen Buddhism. It all started when his life imploded after meeting a beautiful young man.
He met Merce Cunningham, a brilliant dancer in Seattle in 1938. Cage saw into the future and saw that if he paired his music with Cunningham's choreography, they would change the world. Cunningham was recognized instantly by Martha Graham, who invited him to her company, and he was dancing on Broadway by 1939. So Cage is left hanging there in Seattle, and it takes him until 1942 to get to New York with his wife. So when he gets to New York, he starts to partner with Cunningham in more ways than one, and his marriage falls apart, and Cage is completely upended. He doesn't know what he's doing, and so he has this collapse crisis. So the first thing he does is that for 10 years, he immerses himself in Indian philosophy, writers and thinkers who tell him that there is such a thing as silence.
Thank you. Cage wanted music to sober and quieten his mind and make it susceptible to divine influences. Zen would now open that door for him.
Through the 40s, Cage was seeing silence as an idea. And if he just found the right ideas, he could become silent and his music could become silent. But the process of really becoming silent began when he met Dichizuki.
Before studying Zen, men are men, and mountains are mountains. While studying Zen, things become confused. After studying Zen, men are men, and mountains are mountains. After telling this, Dr. Suzuki was asked, "What is the difference between before and after?" He said, "No difference. Only the feet are a little bit off the ground."
Suzuki gave a talk in which he said the true Zen is to go into what you can't see, into formlessness, and to find in formlessness the truth of who you are.
Cage is at Harvard at one point, and he knows that Harvard has an anechoic chamber. Cage walks in and sits down, and he's expecting this great revelation. That he's expecting to find shunyata, right? Emptiness, right? No! What he hears is himself.
The anechoic chamber at Harvard University was then the quietest room in the world and was used in scientific military experiments. In this place, Cage had his epiphany with silence, an experience that would change his life and music forever.
I expected to hear no sound at all because it was a room made as silent as possible. But in that room, I heard two sounds. And I was so surprised that I went to the engineer in charge when I left the room and said, "There's something wrong. There are two sounds in that room." And he said, "Describe them," and I did. And one was high and one was low. And he said, "The high one was my nervous system in operation, and the low one was my blood circulating." So I realized that I was making music unintentionally, continuously.
He hears his heart beating. He hears his own existence. He recognizes that there is no such thing as silence, that silence is a phantom of language, and that in truth, we are already immersed in the ocean. The ocean already is us. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. So 433 is a direct response to Cage's experience of wholeness in the anechoic chamber.
This thing that I mean when I say not anything happening is what I call silence. That is to say, a state of affairs free of intention. Because we always have sounds, for instance. Therefore, we don't have any silence available in the world. We're in a world of sounds. We call it silence when we don't feel a direct connection with the intentions that produce the sounds. We say that it's quiet when, due to our non-intention, there don't seem to us to be many sounds. When there seem to us to be many, we say that it's noisy. But there is no real essential difference between a noisy silence and a quiet silence. The thing that runs through from the quietness to the noise is the state of non-intention, and it is this state that interests me.
There's an anechoic chamber in the UK that's so quiet you can't even hear a pin drop. Researcher Nickel Mystery is our guide.
Welcome, Robert, to the Institute of Sound and Vibration Research's acoustic test facilities at the University of Southampton. We're now heading towards the anechoic chamber.
I want to see if you can experience the void in this soundproof room that Cage searched for. Or will you discover, like Cage did, that there's no such thing as silence?
You start to hear things that you didn't recognise when you were outside. Things like your blood flow or your tinnitus, they become the main feature of your new acoustic soundscape.
This is like being John Cage. I can imagine that I'm inside his head, listening intensely.
So when you hear that blood flow, you're almost aware of your own existence. It's almost quite a Zen-like experience.
For Kay Larson, Cage becomes the salt doll found in Hindu scripture. Wanting to find out how deep the ocean is, he dissolves as he walks into it.
If you really experience 433, if you're totally present for it, there are no thoughts. There is no interpretation. It is what it is.
For Cage, Zen was the structure of the mind, and it enabled him to ring-fence his ego, giving him the discipline to give up his likes and dislikes, a characteristic Cage thought was shared by all the world's religions. And embracing chance operations, he thought he could distance himself from his aesthetic judgments, and through tossing coins, he himself, his ego, would become absent and truly silent.
It was a new kind of compositional style, which was upsetting to the world, which he liked because it shook things up. But it was also meant that whatever he did, it would produce something that he couldn't anticipate. So he was changed by that which he did.
It was the chance gift of an ancient book of Chinese divination that opened the door of silence in Cage's life. Christian Wolff.
My parents being publishers, there were books around, and they had just published for the Bollingen series a new English translation of the I Ching. And so I thought, well, I knew Cage was interested in Oriental philosophy and thinking and religion and so forth, because the Zen thing had already been going on. So I thought, well, this looks like something he'd be interested in, so I brought it along.
If you think about what it's like to spend an entire year throwing 3 coins 6 times, to get the I Ching to answer your next compositional question, that is a huge, demanding process of getting your ego out of the way and listening to some other method of making art that is not about self-expression and not about ego.
In the course of a lecture last winter at Columbia, Suzuki said that there was a difference between Oriental thinking and European thinking, that in European thinking, things are seen as causing one another and having effects, whereas in Oriental thinking, this seeing of cause and effect is not emphasized, but instead one makes an identification with what is here and now. He then spoke of two qualities. Unimpededness and interpenetration.
He didn't actually use the I Ching so much as he used the principle behind the I Ching, which is to say that every answer answers every question. That's come straight out of Zen. You know, everything is the center of the universe, sentient, non-sentient. You know, everything is its own.
So that when one says that there is no cause and effect, what is meant is that there are an incalculable infinity of causes and effects. That in fact, each and everything in all of time and space is related to each and every other thing in all of time and space. This being so, there is no need to cautiously proceed in dualistic terms of success and failure, or the beautiful and the ugly, or good and evil, but rather simply to walk on, not wondering, to quote Meister Eckhart, am I right or doing something wrong?
Cage changed the process of composition from one of making music to one of accepting music, and this had a profound impact on his idea of silence.
It's only with the adoption of chance techniques that he realizes, oh, I can be completely silent about where my sounds are going. I can personally be totally silent about that and let them just speak for themselves. And that's where then his music becomes all silence, and his definition of silence as unintended sound It means everything he wrote from, you know, 1952 onwards was silent. It was all unintended sounds.
I think this enormous shift in his worldview is where some of the confusion surrounding the underlying principles of Cage's music arises. Even critics struggle to understand him, and Cage felt that the only legitimate criticism they could make would be to question the questions he asked in his music.
Why do I have to go on asking questions? Is it the same reason I have to go on writing music? But it's clear, isn't it, I'm not writing music just now? Then why do they call me a composer if all I do is ask questions? What if a B-flat, as they say, just comes to me? How can I get it to come to me of itself, not just pop up out of my memory, taste, and psychology? How? Do you know how? And if I did, or somebody else did, find a way to let a sound be itself, would everybody within earshot be able to listen to it?
The near hour-long Music of Changes is, I think, Cage's first I Ching masterpiece. Each and every sound is determined by the toss of three coins. It took a year of his life to write and to keep food on the table. He sold shares in it to his friends. Hearing it for the first time, fellow composer Morton Feldman said it sounded photographically still. To me, the sounds appear out of the silence like the flashes of subatomic particles in the Large Hadron Collider. But in 1962 in Japan, Cage stretched his idea that silence is unintended sound to the limit with the premiere of 0 minutes and 0 seconds. He called it his 4 minutes 33 seconds number 2. Interestingly, this work was dedicated to the young Yoko Ono and her husband Toshi Ishinigi, whom Cage had met in New York in 1959.
They were living in the Upper West Side on Amsterdam Avenue. And Toshi Ishinagi had been attending Juilliard and was bored with it. He thought Western music was not solving the problems he wanted to solve in music. So he started attending John Cage's class. And Yoko would come with him. I've been told by Alan Capro, that who also was in those classes, that he saw Yoko sitting in on those classes all the time, even though she wasn't officially enrolled. Indeed, it was almost inevitable that Yoko Ono would have met John Cage. Incidentally, she called him J.C. Jesus Christ because he was always preaching.
When Yoko first met Cage, she exclaimed, "This is it!" She knew that she had met her spiritual soulmate. She instantly recognized the Zen influence in his work. Cage biographer David Revel.
Cage's first career idea was to enter the ministry, and he did, in effect, become a minister of sound because his approach to music was very much a spiritual one, but his approach to spirituality was through the lens of music.
In 1962, Mr. and Mrs. Ishinigi invited Cage, the pianist David Tudor, and the wealthy art collector Peggy Guggenheim on a concert and sightseeing tour of Japan.
He loved Japanese culture. I mean, he's obviously very connected to it. In particular, the rock garden at Ryoanji, this Zen garden that's just, you know, stones in raked sand. It's a space in which things have been placed. And he, of course, very famously believed that those stones could have been put anywhere in that space. And he would have, no doubt, have, you know, measured the space carefully and determined randomly where each stone would go. And that's what he effectively thought the designer had done, even though there'd been all manner of studies about, you know, what the significance of the different locations are. He loved that garden for that reason. It was directly analogous to what he was doing in his music.
The Sugetsu Art Center were their generous hosts. They had done much to promote Cage before his arrival, as well as organizing the tourist itinerary and the concert performances that turned Cage into a world celebrity.
The first thing that John Cage did when he got to Japan was he visited D.C. Suzuki. And there are photos of them, according to Miyoko Okamura, who was there. They didn't say anything. They just sat in each other's presence, which, if you know Zen masters, is quite often what happens. So it was extremely important for Cage that he acknowledge his teacher.
But the highlight of the tour was that unforgettable night in Tokyo on October the 24th when Cage first performed 0 minutes 0 seconds, or 4 minutes 33 seconds number 2, which would blur the distinction between his life and art and between silence and sound.
I feel like this is the piece that he got it right. He performed this piece all the time. It's another silent piece. It's about silence. And I really believe this is the one that Cage wrote to be the sort of the replacement for 4:33. 4 minutes and 33 seconds, I think he had a very uneasy relationship with, let's put it that way. And this was the version that was going to fix all the bugs that were in the original 4:33.
I would say that 0 minutes, 0 seconds is more of a musical composition than is 4:33. I think that 4:33 shares more with the art world. You know, it comes out of blank canvas. It comes out of a very young way of thinking about the world. I don't think he could have done 0 minutes, 0 seconds unless he had done 4:33. I think it was en route.
The piece is just this simple statement that you, with maximum amplification, perform an action, right? And the first performance of it, famously, was him actually writing that sentence out with contact mics on the paper and everything, so you heard this.
The idea behind the piece is simplicity itself, aided by a brilliant Japanese sound technician, Junosuke Okuyama. Cage put noise, his underdog of music, center stage.
What this piece tries to say is that everything we do is music or can become music through the use of microphones, meaning that everything we do creates this unintended sound that is beautiful, that by turning towards that unintended sound, that's what music is, right? It's our relationship to that sound makes it musical.
The Japanese composer Yasunao Tone is one of the few people left alive who was there, and I'm touched by his simple description of the performers.
Cage wore black suits, Tudor wore dark blue suits, Ichiyanagi wore grey flannel suits, Yoko Ono wore black dress. The stage settings were minimal, sometimes nothing at all.
But the visit was about a profound exchange of ideas. Cage specialist Professor Toshi Kakenuma.
People were surprised to see an American composer talked about Zen, and I think it made Japanese people interested in Zen. So it's kind of reverse importation.
Simultaneous performances of solo for piano and aria with Fontana mix were also recorded during the Japanese tour, and Yoko Ono's extraordinary vocal range was pushed to the limit.
Oh.
Uncannily, Yoko was also conceptually in tune with Cage, having written a work entitled Silent Music in March 1952, while she was a philosophy student in Japan, 5 months before the Woodstock premiere of 4 minutes 33 seconds. Cage left Japan triumphant. The poverty of his heroic decade over, he'd secured a music publishing deal, and his influential book, Silence, was critically acclaimed. Yet, increasingly, 4 minutes 33 seconds was beginning to define him and silence the rest of his music. The public thought he was a Dadaist joker, a prankster, a charlatan. The European avant-garde washed their hands of him.
I think he actually regretted it after he did it. He knew where it came from his spiritual quest and his inner silence connected to outer silence and so forth. It had this spiritual dimension and this very impersonal, like beyond the ego kind of sense. And then it went out into the world and everybody projected their own thinking onto it. And it was just not what he had in mind at all. And I think that's one reason he kind of left it in the shadows a bit as he moved on to other things.
But I don't think he regretted it in theory, so to speak. I mean, it's something he wanted to do and he did it. And he would, I think, periodically say that when asked what was his favorite composition of his own, he would always say it was 4 minutes, 33 seconds.
John said to me when we parted for the last time, "Robert, get out of whatever cage you happen to be in. 4 minutes, 33 seconds is the key to the door of the cage."
Cage is asking us to take everything seriously and playfully at the same time. Not as a joke, but to feel the weight and to feel the lightness.
I would like to leave things alive and mysterious, if I can.
Perhaps the final paradox is that 4 minutes 33 seconds opens a space for all of us, and we fill it.
I have nothing to say, and I am saying it. And that is poetry, as I need it. We need not fear these silences. We may love them.
A lot of voices contributed to this program. Kyle Gann, Gavin Bryars, James Pritchett, Kay Larson, Paul Griffiths, Martin Iden, Christian Wolfe, David Revel, and others, even yours truly. But I'd like to close tonight's program with Cage's voice by reciting the letter he wrote to Helen Wolfe in response to the one she wrote to him, the one to which Christian Wolfe alludes to in Silent Witness. In essence, learning from her son about Cage's 433 and that it would be included in the New York recital at Carl Fisher Concert Hall on April 14th, she was appalled. She wrote to Cage on April 9th, admonishing him for what she saw as a schoolboy's prank and pleaded with him not to go through with it. She likened Cage's piece to something she knew about, publishing, alluding, of course, to Pantheon Books, which she and her husband, Kurt, had founded in 1942. And in her view, Cage's announcement of his silent piece corresponded to announcing a volume of poetry and then contributing a bound set of blank pages. "If we did this," she said, "we would be considered not even jokers, but frauds." Cage responded kindly and quickly, as follows, from an undated letter circa a day or so later, April 11th. Dear Helen, the piece is not actually silent. There will never be silence until death comes, which never comes. It is full of sound, but sounds which I did not think of beforehand, which I hear for the first time the same time others hear. What we hear is determined by our own emptiness, our own receptivity. We receive to the extent we are empty to do so. If one is full, or in the course of its performance becomes full of an idea, for example, that this piece is a trick for shock and bewilderment, then it is just that. However, nothing is single or unidimensional. This is an action among the 10,000. It moves in all directions and will be received in unpredictable ways. These will vary from shock and bewilderment to quietness of mind and enlightenment. If one imagines that I have intended any one of these responses, he will have to imagine that I have intended all of them. Something like faith must take over in order that we live affirmatively in the totality we do live in. With or without my intention, my art is cheapened and made expensive. That is not my concern. A death to myself takes place in composing, and in the event of the movement of this composition in the world, a second death to it as mine must take place. Otherwise, I shall be in fear and trembling, in a perilous situation of my own imagination. You know my constant interest in Oriental thought, and you may think this has been misused to bring about a musical action which you cannot accept. As I see it, useful art has been illustrative or significant of belief, didactic. But what is that art which is not didactic nor symbolic, but to be experienced following having been taught? Clearly, life itself, of which we have only to become aware. I am therefore not concerned with art as separate from such awareness, nor is the I Ching, hexagram 22, grace. Another friend of mine was disturbed about 4:33 and said with some heat that I apparently thought him stupid and incapable of hearing the sounds of everyday life, which he informed me he could and would with pleasure. I asked him why, if in private he could hear, he was disturbed to foresee doing so in public. To this he had to say, "You have a point." However, I do not wish to win an argument, nor will I. I also consulted the I Ching after receiving your letter and got exhaustion. Number 47. 4:33 is also a matter of consultation. Each person present will receive his own hexagram. I send this not to defend myself, but out of love for you and a sense of responsibility to you and to Mr. Wolfe through my relation to Christian, from which I am not free. It is for that reason, being aware of your concern, that I repeat my practical offer to warn your friends of the experience in store for them. You have only to give me a list of names and addresses. P.S. Incidentally, it was not I, but David Tudor, who decided upon the program. I do not say this to shift the responsibility, but that you may be informed of how things actually take place. I composed the piece nearly 2 years ago. It was performed by David with mixed reactions at Woodstock, New York. The piece exists in the repertoire, and he chose to program it at the present time. I myself am detached. I am busy with other things, a new composition, concert details of management, this letter, and this springtime. By the way, Cage consulted the I Ching, receiving hexagram 47, exhaustion, also known as oppression, because Helen Wolfe did, writing to Cage that when she consulted the I Ching over her worry about the piece, she got hexagram 4, youthful folly, also known as inexperience.
Hi,
Laura Kuhn here again, host of All Things Cage, produced by the John Cage Trust for WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears and syndicated nationally by Wave Farm. I'd like to take a moment to appeal for your support. Wave Farm remains tirelessly committed to making the airwaves a participatory medium. This adventurous organization is a pioneer of the transmission arts genre, inviting artists and community members to actively access and engage the airwaves that surround them. These activities are made possible in part from state and federal art grants, foundation support, and earned income. But private, tax-deductible support from individuals like you provides a critical piece of the puzzle. Listener support keeps Wave Farm programs afloat, especially WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. And we are grateful to the many individuals who have shown their generosity, past, present, and future. I hope you will consider becoming a WGXC sustaining supporter like me by going to wgxc.org/donate and selecting an amount of your choosing that will be charged to your credit card. Your tax-deductible financial support allows WGXC to meet its most basic operating costs and keeps WGXC on your FM dial. Thank you for listening. And thank you for your support.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.